nothing is more expensive than bad information. Know the source. OneRadioNetwork.com.
Well, a very pleasant good morning to you. This is Patrick Timpone, and this is OneRadioNetwork.com. It is Wednesday, May 20th. We generally do a few different things on Wednesday. We often talk about money, finances, and such on Wednesdays, and I think we'll even do a little bit of that with our first guest, Matthew Arrett, because he's got some interesting writings on the current financial situation on his website, and I think we'll, after we deal with the first subject, maybe we'll dig in a little bit, time permitting, about the potential of maybe a debt jubilee coming up, or maybe just more monetary inflation. As you know, the Federal Reserve, well, if you listen here, I think the Federal Reserve Bank has created about $4 trillion. Well, not quite four, maybe three and a half or so trillion on their balance sheet that we look at from time to time, and that's just made up money. So we'll talk to Matthew about that. Also, David Martin is scheduled to be here at 10:30. Scheduled because I haven't heard from him in 2 days, so that sometimes is not good, but I think it'll play out. We've been talking for a couple of weeks. He's a very interesting fellow, and he digs into the legalities, the constitutionality, Declaration of Independence, and cool things like that concerning what governors and bureaucrats in these health departments are telling people what to do, and people are doing it. And turns out that, according to David Martin, and he's got some pretty deep research, he just doesn't make stuff up, and that's why he's fun, is that they just make this stuff as they go, and none of this stuff that the governors and the health departments and mayors and are telling you to do is constitutional, not even close. I think 48 out of 50 states they are on unconstitutional grounds. Evidently, Maine and Oklahoma, strangely enough, that they are legal, telling you. But we'll talk more about it if that comes off as we suspect it may. Matthew Arrett is here. I came across a very interesting article about the X Club created by Huxley. You've heard of Thomas Huxley, many years ago, back in 1865, around Lincoln's time in the Civil War, and Nature Magazine and Darwinism and this whole religion of science that they came up with. The Nature Magazine to this day is still one of the most respected scientific journals out there, and they've done some pretty strange things over the years, including really bombing this fellow who was talking about how water has a memory, and we'll talk a bit about that too. And we know that's real. We've talked about on this show for 20 years, the memory of water and the magnificent power and actual memory. But Nature Magazine destroyed some guy. But anyway, so Matthew's going to come on and say hi now. Let me find his little short little bio here. He's a journalist, but really quite a historian as well. Co-founder of the Rising Tide Foundation and the Canadian Patriot Review. He's up in Montreal. He's published scientific articles with 21st Century Science and Technology. He's a regular author on several political, cultural websites, including Los Angeles Review of Books, China Channel, Strategic Culture, Off Guardian, and The Duran. Also authored 3 books from the series The Untold History of Canada. I think it was Huey P. Long one time said, the only thing new in this world is the history that we don't know, which is kind of fun. Matthew Arrett, good morning.
Hey, good morning, Patrick. Thank you for having me on.
Yeah. Is that a for real Huey P. Long quote? The only thing new in the world is the history we don't know? Do you know?
I don't know about that one. I know of the History Ain't What It Used to Be by Yogi Berra.
That's right. That one. Yeah, that's a good one, too. How are things up in Montreal? Y'all sheltering in place and obeying the boys and all that?
Oh, yeah, the fear factor is at full force. It's an interesting sociological experiment to live through. But I think overall there's a certain air of life that's beginning to pop back up again with the sun.
Yeah.
Re-emerging after the winter.
Yeah, it feels like that too, Matthew. And I also noticed on your website you're quite a financial monetary geek like I am, and our show does. And so maybe we can, as I said, as time permits, we can dig into that a little bit. You had a very good article about that. But let's go way, way back. And this whole idea of Nature Magazine, Darwinism, and science. And you write that there were, at some point early on, around the time of Lincoln, there was this big kind of rift going on where Britain, who had their, you know, their hands in central banking and such, they were beginning to feel like they were going to lose control of this whole empire thing.
Yes, that's right. Yeah, one of the keys that I found to be of great use in unlocking a lot of the Gordian knots of history was recognizing that the empire, the British Empire, that had dominated the world for so many hundreds of years, never thought of itself and never acted as a military empire. It never even acted simply as a banking empire, though it needed military and banking functions. It operated, if you get into the mind of one of the higher level controllers, a Lord Palmerston or a Lord John Russell, for example, or a member of the black nobility, managing this sort of thing from the top, it was always seen as a cultural warfare. Scientific management was always part of the package. And certainly this came to a head around the period of the late middle to late 19th century, expressed in the form of the U.S. Civil War, which, as you pointed out, yes, the London banks had worked very hard to strangle the United States of any chance of credit. I mean, if people know of the famous story of Lincoln having been given the gracious offer of 30% interest loans by Wall Street and London banks to keep the union intact. It wasn't a loan. This was a fraud. I mean, he knew this was a joke, which is where the idea came out of his network to create the greenbacks to self-finance, which was a constitutional form of credit, which is the only legitimate form of credit permissible in the American system, which the British hate. And I wouldn't say all the British people, because the British people were very much in favor of the Union's position against slavery, but the aristocracy wanted completely the Confederacy and the slave institution, more importantly, to dominate for the they wanted the breakup of the Union. Yeah. So essentially a divide to conquer.
Yeah. So it was, even back then, kind of where it's called, the term is all often used here, bankers' wars, really. The bankers were in on this. We've had people say the bankers were planning this thing out for 10, 20 years, Civil War.
Oh yeah, absolutely. This is. I would say as soon as the American Revolution had just ended, and they were already thinking about how do you use the greatest Achilles heel in America, which was the dichotomization between the slave owning the slave power faction and the side in the North that preferred to have industry and were against slavery. People that followed Benjamin Franklin's way of thinking more than the Thomas Jefferson Jackson view that no, man, some people are born slaves because of their skin color. So the British oligarchy, the financial oligarchy, had always exploited that weakness inside of America and worked it throughout the entire 19th century, and it culminated through a lot of fuel on the fire through British intrigue. And a lot of British puppets who were positioned into power positions in American presidencies. It culminated in the Civil War. Yeah, and you bring up how I write about the origins of Darwinism and this whole scientific rift.
Yeah, that's just real fascinating. And that's really comes back to what's going on today, right, Matthew? And this whole WHO and Fauci and it's like a religion. So let's get into that. You write about some kind of a club by Huxley was put together, X Club, and there were 12 of them. And and one of them was a real Darwinist kind of guy. Explain to us really what the, in simplest terms, for those of us who were mostly sleeping during this class, Darwin's proposition. I mean, what was his basic idea, Darwinism?
Sure, yeah. Well, this group, this X Club, I mean, it sounds like something out of a comic book. This was a group that was set up under the leadership of Thomas H. Huxley, the father of Leonard Huxley, the founder of the, or the leader of the British Eugenics Society, and the grandfather of Aldous and Julian Huxley. Mm-hmm. Julian being the guy who invented UNESCO and also ran the Eugenics Society, and Aldous being, you know, Brave New World fame. This was a group of leading British imperialist scientists that were recruited to reform British science policy because, I mean, people have to, just to, before I say anything about Darwin, I really want people to appreciate the world of transformation and creative leaps that were happening throughout the 18th and 19th century, mm-hmm. Led in large measure by forces within America like... I mean, Benjamin Franklin himself was known as the Prometheus of America. He wasn't just the father of the American Revolution, but he was the leading thinker who discovered the nature of electricity and trumped all of the, you know, the most noble European scientists of the world, but also brought it down to improve the life of man, which is the key. That he, I mean, for Ben Franklin's thinking and people who thought like him, like Alexander von Humboldt later on, the idea of political emancipation from monarchy and hereditary power structures, and the principle of scientific discovery of natural law, the law of, in their mind, it was not a science was not dichotomized between religion and God on the one side and man's logic, which proves the irrationality or the non-existence of God, in the other hand. That dichotomization that we suffer from today was not there in those days, and that the fact that it wasn't there is also, I would say, what gave birth to some of these wonderful revolutions of paradigm-shifting science. And the rate of new discoveries was just unbounded, and it was something that was very disruptive to those in the British imperial courts that wished to keep a system of equilibrium control in place. And obviously, anytime you introduce a new idea that's not monopolized, it creates a lot of disequilibrium, a lot of lack of control. Imperialists hate that. They hate that the effects of real creative thought.
So
this is what they had to really in the mid 1800s, it was becoming realized that the old nobility was too mentally lazy to stifle the explosion of these discoveries. They were not mentally rigorous enough. Because they were set in their ways. You know, you're dealing with blue bloodlines, people born into prestigious families who don't like doing a lot of work. So how do you counteract the electric polarized, discoveries? They're not sophisticated. So they had to find a new way of doing things. They recruited talented misanthropes like T.H. Huxley from the lower castes. And many of these scientists, some came from the higher up caste, but most of them were from the lower, who were just united in their common view that they wanted to be, you know, used managers of an empire. And so they were given the responsibility to reorganize the empire's scientific management policies. And all of them, basically what united them is that whether it was in botany, mathematics, physics, chemistry, because each had their own field of specialization, the humanities, sociology, psychology. Herbert Spencer was among them, the social Darwinist, as well as Matthew Arnold, the educational reformer. They were all united in their commitment to get rid of, to smother out the idea of these nonlinear creative leaps, which we find in nature when we explore nature. We also find it in the human mind when we explore what our own mind does, when we make a discovery and we discover that there's something. If we've all done this and thought about what our mind did when we went from a period of ignorance of something to a eureka, there was something that was not purely deductive or inductive reasoning.
Yes.
Pure. It wasn't an extension of logic. It was something else was also at play, which was something more spiritual.
Yes.
That gave birth to that. Aha. So they wanted to get rid of that idea, and so they created a new religion of science to turn off your mind, let scientific modeling define how you think for you, how teams of experts would now think for you, which would mathematize the universe, plugging the universe into a formal idea or abstract idea that, you know, you could just imagine that maybe a mechanism could be discovered that could help run society.
Yeah.
Darwinism was the selected instrument for that, and Huxley became early on his handler. I would just say, sorry, one thing.
I don't want
to cut you off there, but
no, go ahead.
The London Imperial College, which has played such a big role in today's coronavirus propaganda, mm-hmm. in terms of producing all of the predictive models that gave birth and justified the lockdowns of Europe and North America. Mm. So the London Imperial College came out of this too by Prince Albert, the Queen's consort, Queen Victoria. And Prince Albert was one of these guys who took responsibility for creating the Royal Imperial College. And Huxley was made the controller of it in 1880, the part of the college that controlled all science and naturalism. And that today this is what is today managing the statistics. Again, that's being adopted and used all around the world around COVID. It's easy to fake statistics.
Interesting. So the London Imperial College, they're top of the food chain with this COVID thing and all the predictive models of how many people are going to die and where it comes from and what you got to do. That actually, that whole, this science as a religion has been around for a long time, even before the X Club thing in the 1860s, right? These guys were around for a long time, kind of thinking they were running the world, Matthew?
Oh, yeah. You know, I make the point in my paper that Malthus, a lot of these guys, that they're all essentially followers of Thomas Malthus. So is Darwin, for that matter. And Darwin even writes, and keep in mind, Darwin's lesser-known entire title of his 1859 book was not just The Origin of Species. It was The Origin of Species by Means of Natural Selection or The Preservation of the Favored Races in the Struggle for Life. So Darwin, think about it. He's very clear that he's looking at nature from the standpoint of a struggle between favored races and unfavored races in life. Now, what he admits in his autobiography, he actually writes how he discovered his theory by reading Thomas Malthus's Essays on Population from 1799. He literally says, while he was traveling on the Beagle in 1838, that he was just struggling with this and couldn't figure it out until he says, it once struck me that under these circumstances, favorable variations would tend to be preserved and unfavorable ones to be destroyed. This, the result would be the formation of new species. Here then I at least got a theory by which to work. Now, who is Malthus? Okay, so if you really dig into Malthus, this is the guy who worked for the British East India Company's Helliberry College. He was a so-called reverend. Not really, though. I mean, this guy was completely satanic, and I don't use that word lightly. Mm-hmm. But he advocated in his book that we should facilitate instead of foolishly and vainly endeavoring to impede the operations of nature and producing the mortality. And if we dread the too frequent visitation of the horrid form of famine, we should sedulously encourage the other forms of destruction, which we compel nature to use. In our towns, we should make the streets narrower, crowd more people into houses, and court the return of the plague. And he's talking. He also talks about the need to kill off babies to make room for healthier babies if you have too many poor babies or sick babies. He's cold, and he's the guy who comes up with this formula saying, well, you know, if under any system of empire where human beings are not allowed to use their creative thinking, we naturally get the effect of overpopulation because populations reproduce geometrically while their food growth, their food agriculture reproduces arithmetically, causing a natural crisis point at some point down the line. Of course, you know, this formula, just between you and me, this only works if you don't let people develop their creative potentials, obviously. Mm-hmm. If they act like cattle, sure, they will grow and encounter the same population crises as any form of animal in the ecosystem, which, you know, has its own rules of population that human beings, we have free will, so we can choose to behave that way or not. So he only sees the one way of being, and thus, in his mind, he prescribes how the empire should use the science of limits that he develops to cull the human herd occasionally in order to preserve this equilibrium. Now, I mean, he's not a scientist and he's not really a sociologist. He's just a peon of the empire justifying the existence of empire. Darwin took his system and just applied it to all of nature. And all of these different X-Club members, I mean, some of them like T.H. Huxley, didn't even believe in Darwinism as a very good theory describing the flow of evolution, because even Huxley, you know, he himself preferred I mean, he preferred the theories of Georges Etienne Saint-Hilaire and Georges Cuvier, who were actual real creative biologists, and he wrote so in his letters. But he saw it as a politically useful thing, not as a scientific doctrine, but just as a political doctrine, Darwinism.
So these eugenicists, how do you say it?
Eugenicists.
Eugenicists today, the whole, the Gates, WHO, and all these folks, this idea is, you know, 200-300 years old and has been kind of in the wind, so to speak, with the same people since then, right? And it just...
Absolutely, yeah. And I mean, Galton, Francis Galton, who was the founder of the modern form of eugenicism that was adopted by Hitler, you know, this guy, he was the cousin of Darwin. Herbert Spencer, the founder of social Darwinism, was also part of this X Club. And Darwin's kids, Leonard Darwin, Horace Darwin, were all leaders of the eugenic societies, who collaborated with people like John Maynard Keynes and the Huxleys. This has been around for a while. And you mentioned Bill Gates and these things. I mean, if you look at what Bill Gates came out of, I mean, he's not just some techie Harvard dropout. You know, his father, Bill Gates Sr., was a close friend of David Rockefeller and worked as the head of Planned Parenthood for a long time. Planned Parenthood, for anybody looking at their history, came out of the American Eugenic Society of, you know, Margaret Sanger. That was funded always by the Rockefeller Foundation. Hmm. So who funded eugenics? Who funded Francis Galton and the bringing of this British scheme of eugenics into America? Was the Rockefeller Foundation, who also funded it in Germany. He was the one who funded Mengele. The Rockefeller Foundation and the Carnegie Foundation funded Mengele's research in the 1930s. The eugenics laws that were passed in 33 American states were mass sterilization based on the statistical, basically they would just look at the statistical chances that your children or grandchildren would have low IQs or criminal tendencies based upon your parents, grandparents, and great-grandparents. That's really what they would do. And they would just do linear predictive modeling onto your unborn children to justify whether it was scientifically justifiable to sterilize people, which they did en masse in Canada as well as the U.S. before even Germany did.
And what year was this when they were doing this? Mass sterilizations?
Yeah, well, Indiana was the first to pass these Rockefeller-funded eugenics laws in America in 1907, and that continued all the way through the 1930s and 40s. Unfortunately, even into the 50s, they were still doing sterilization, especially in the Native American community in America and Canada.
And then I guess Carnegie and Rockefeller, they were involved with the whole medical model we have today, right, in the early 1900s, bringing that whole thing out. With long hospital stays, surgery, and pharmaceutical drugs.
Yeah, there was a much more creative approach in the 1900s in America towards medicine that was not standardized. There was no standard model of officially evidence-based medicine that everybody had to adhere to and adopt. There was much more liberty in doctors and nurses and pharmacists to explore all sorts of paths, outside of the box paths that were zeroing in on the real causes of cancers and of other things. Mm-hmm. So yeah, you hit the nail on the head. It was the Carnegie and Rockefeller foundations that were I wouldn't put them in a causal nexus. Cause I do think that the Rockefeller and Carnegie families, just like the Huxley or Darwin families are useful tools to do dirty work for a higher power, but I don't want people to think of that as an enemy image, you know? But they were the ones to put the money and the program into creating a centralized form of behaviorism in medicine and health science as a science, as well as the deployment of treatments that all vectored around increasingly symptoms and chemical-based remedies for symptoms rather than causes, which disrupted the entire 20th century flow of health science, as I'm sure you and your viewers know.
Yeah, which of course, Matthew, stay right there. We're going to take a little break. Wow. Good stuff, man. This guy knows his stuff. I'm Matthew Arrett in history, and so we're going to get back to this X Club in Nature magazine and how this got started and how Nature is still one of the most prestigious kind of scientific journals today. And it goes back, 200 years, 1865, 1965, 150 years. Well, if you'd like to join the show, 888-663-6386, email patrick@oneradionetwork.com. Here's a great little product for your teeth and also internally. Previously with Dr. Rulin Chu about her product called Pearlseum. So let's talk about the teeth first. Explain to me what's going on, because there's something magical when you dip your little toothbrush in water. Why do they look so sparkly and just, I don't know, something very energetically about the look of them?
Yeah, it's very, very magical. So like a group of scientists in France discovered that when you put pearl next to the bones or skins or other connective tissues, and they find it stimulates new growth of the bones and skins and connective tissues, and also to make existing bones and the skins more healthy and stronger. So brush your teeth with the pearl, then your teeth will make your existing teeth stronger, and also it will filling up, you know, teeth with the pearlseum, and the pearl powder will stimulate the new bone growth and also make the existing teeth very strong.
It's really a great product. You'll love it. Take it internally or on your teeth, and you can click an order, see the ad right there, Pearlseum, the nice green container, Pearlseum, on OneRadioNetwork.com. We're so blessed to be able to promote this and use it. I just got three more containers about a week ago. I like to get three at a time. It's the best price. Yeah, I pay for it too. And you can take this internally. You can put in some face cream. Pearl has been used, in Ayurvedic medicine, Chinese medicine, for beauty and longevity. It's from a once living source, which is pretty cool if you really dig in. We like to always put once living source things into our body and not something made in a lab, because the body knows the difference. Max Planck Institute talked about that long, long ago, and it's all a vibrational thing. And so Pearl is from real pearls, and she figured out a way how to make this pearl into a powder without messing up the whole energetics and the vibration and the cellular matrix of it. And you brush your teeth with it, I don't think you've ever seen a substance that will clean the teeth. You'll never have to go and get your teeth cleaned again. If you can do it on the inside and gets rid of tar. I mean, but it doesn't do a white thing like a bleach. It's more a real pearly look to it. Hence the name, which is the real, and it's actually making the tooth enamel stronger, and the pearl look that teeth get is from the light coming in and bouncing off on the internal part of the tooth. It's not a tooth becoming more white like the Hollywood kind of thing, and they bleach them up, and you see how phony that looks. A pearl is pearl. That's why we call them pearly whites. It's an amazing product, Pearlseum. I would get two or three to start your day, to start your experience with it. It's the best way to do it. Pearlseum, OneRadioNetwork.com. I've known Brandon Amalani for probably since this show started. He used to do some work for Daniel Vitalis. He's quite a researcher, Qigong and Chinese medicine guy. And if you'd like to look into some different berries as amazing elixirs, superfoods. He has a Shizandra tincture and a goji berry tincture. You can get a combo, a really nice combo for $75. Get two of those, I mean one of those each, and you can click on it and see how he grows these. They own their own farm up there on the Goji. They get Shizandra, they're all organic and in Myron glass and just exquisitely produced. Boy, look at the ingredients and see how they produce them. And you'll want to get some. You know, you just read this stuff. He has a Hoshu Wu formula that's just out of control. I'd really like you to consider this Grotein, a nutritional protein, which is, it's the most exquisite kind of a protein that I've ever come across. And the ingredients are just like crazy different from anything that you've ever come across. For example, in the nutritional formula, the Grotein, check out this ingredient panel. Bamboo pith and leaf, pinion nut, plantain, nettles, beet tops root, kaiso, chlorella, spirulina, nashi sabatinton, aloe, pear tops, pumpkin seed concentrate, sesame seed, quinoa, hemp seeds, tomato seed, on and on and on, Job's tears, Brazil nut. Now, how's that for a drink that you like to have? I had some this morning. Licorice root, basil, Gota Cola. This is unlike those heavy, kind of more protein drinks out there, even the whey protein or these a lot of these brown rice proteins. I never could do well with them at all. They just were too heavy, but this thing is so light. First ingredient, bamboo pith. So it's some really good vitamins, minerals, and nutrients, and it's called Grotein. It's in our store, and also when you click on the Shen Blossom ad on the front page of One Radio Network, you'll find it, Grotein, and it's OneRadioNetwork.com and Shen Blossom. Great, great company, just out of control quality that just unmatched. All in Myron glass, too, by the way.
We are listener-supported, One Radio Network.
We're talking with Matthew Arrett, and he's in Canada. And Matthew, your main website is what? So people find your articles. Tell them.
Well, they can go to CanadianPatriot.org, or they can also check out my other site. I run a nonprofit with my wife called RisingTideFoundation.net.
RisingTideFoundation.net. With your wife. Well, good for you. So you're able to make a living doing that? That's very challenging these days, writing and making a living, isn't it?
It takes a lot of creative work, yeah, but it's an experiment. It's a work in progress.
Well, you're a real historian geek. I'm reading some of your articles. It's like, you really like this stuff, don't you? You can tell by how deep you get into it. Have you been like this most of your life?
Oh no, and not at all. Actually, I was a late bloomer, but I really only started developing a fascination. You know, we all have our own experiences and journeys, and I got hit with my own series of truth bombs in 2004 when I was an art student working on an animated documentary in 2004 in university. And the issue of 9/11 came up in that research, and I decided to incorporate some of that. So I decided to put myself, you know, just basically reviewing a little bit of lectures I could find on the internet. And sure enough, you know, the typical set of discoveries happens where the official narrative breaks down. And I went through a bit of a shock for a period as I continued to explore what else was a lie. And turns out almost everything.
almost everything.
And so it took me a while to recalibrate. But I got involved with a political organization for a number of years where, you know, in my view of things, I was like, well, anytime I'm communicating with anybody about what I've discovered, if I'm successful, I just tend to make them depressed. So rather than just lower their energy by making any effort to tell them about the ugly truth of the world, I decided I'm just going to keep my mouth shut, which I did for about a year on politics. Uh-huh. And unless solutions could be brought to my attention, and if something could be conveyed that could give me reasonable hope that this could change, then I would speak about it. And certainly I did encounter that in time, and I began working as a political organizer and an activist for a number of years. And so what came out of that process was the Canadian History Project, which people can see on the website. And more recently, just last year, the Rising Tide Group.
It's interesting, Matthew Arrett. If you'd like to join the show, Patrick at OneRadioNetwork.com. Also, 888-663-6386. When you go back and you look into this time around Lincoln's Civil War, when the Nature magazine was put together by these X-Club guys, by people that we've heard about, the Fabian Society, right, and the Rhodes Scholars, which I guess a lot of people, Matthew, would put these in the category of globalist, internationalist, the New World Order people, right, the Fabian Society and the Rhodes Scholar people. There are a lot of similarities with President Trump today, being a nationalist, protectionist, in a sense, huh?
Oh, yeah. I mean, it's
the same people then are trying to get rid of President Trump or wanted to bomb Lincoln, right?
That's correct. Yeah, it's the same institutions. And that's the thing. Like, there's a lot of effort that's been put into this this idea that infests the thinking of a lot of people today, that the deep past and the influence of the deep past has no useful effect on understanding the present, because the present is the consequence of the direct of yesterday. You know, today is the consequence of yesterday, not 100 years ago. That, you know, it's the same sort of problem. You see it manifest in science, where people say, oh yeah, but the other galaxies could have no influence on our galaxy of the Milky Way, or the center of the galaxy of the Milky Way could have no effect on our solar system, right? Or another star could have no effect on the solar system. It's so far away. If it does have an effect, it's negligible. We can ignore it. It's absurd. Obviously, everything is history is a dynamic, it's a scientific process, and it's not linear in that sense of it just being on a timeline. Same thing for the universe. It's one integral process, right? And you can't, if you don't have that top-down perspective in your mind, then you can't account for things like evolution. How did the appearance of life happen on the Earth? Why here on the Earth, of all the places in the solar system, did it occur the way it did? And how do we see these discontinuous leaps from non-life to life, or from life to conscious life, or from conscious life to creative, self-reasoning life like humans? Incredible leaps that you have to have some idea of galaxies in the universe in your mind as you explore and hypothesize what's occurring. So all that to say, yeah, history is kind of like that too. And you brought up the deep state. Yeah, this was sort of the proto. I would say that the deep state, when you look at history, there always was two Americas from 1776. Part of my work on the Canadian History Project, which manifested in these three books, The Untold History of Canada, that, you know, people can see these on my website if they want, but a lot of the material's freely available. Canada was set up by British United Empire loyalists in 1776, who wanted to stay allied to hereditary institutions, right? And they settled in Canada, and they created Montreal and English-speaking Canada. That's our origin story, unfortunately. It's a fail. It's a failure to be Promethean, to take responsibility for our destiny when we had the chance. And part of this group stayed in America and set up things like Wall Street, the Bank of Manhattan under Aaron Burr, and always remained this British hand inside of America. So America was always at war with its own constitutional traditions, and that was never resolved after the American Revolution. It wasn't resolved after the War of 1812. And even though it was a great success for the constitutional, legitimately American system faction of Lincoln, when they put down this British-sponsored rebellion of the slave power, it took over immediately over Lincoln's dead body. And a lot of his allies tried to continue the defense of his system, both within America and also abroad. You know, people forget that the reason why America was able to succeed in the Civil War, as well as in the American Revolution, was because of an international alliance, in the case of the Civil War, Tsar Alexander II, who was a co-thinker with Lincoln and recognized the evils of the British Empire, what they did to Russia during the Crimean War, which was a trap to destroy and dismantle Russia as well. They sent the entire Russian naval fleet to the coast of America on the Pacific and the Atlantic as a sign to Britain and France to stay out of backing up the Confederacy, which allowed Lincoln the liberty to fend that off. But Yeah, I mean, after the X Club was set up with a new sort of policy, you had a little bit later on the Fabian Society, which created the London School of Economics, to sort of manage the social, to apply social Darwinism under one form to create sort of a socialistic left run by a managerial priesthood. Not to say that every socialist is a social Darwinist, but the ones who controlled it from the top, yes. That was the Fabian group, and they overlapped with the Roundtable and Rhodes Scholarship groups that were also sponsored by people like Cecil Rhodes was a racist race patriot of the worst kind that was like a Churchill, Winston Churchill sort of personality type of his day, and this gave birth to another breed of managers. Upper level managerial class of Rhodes Scholars who were deployed after getting brainwashing in Oxford, were deployed back to whatever home country they came from to advance the agenda of, essentially this one world new British Empire ideology, which was always premised on depopulation, a Malthusian one world government to get rid of nation states, get rid of national governments, institutions, and undo the American Revolution effectively. So yeah, this is directly is behind the battle against Trump and the rise of, Trump's return to the American system it's not a Lincoln or John F. Kennedy expression of it, but it is an expression of it. And it's very important that that is happening now that there is a fight to defend American institutions of nationalism that Trump represents. So there's there's a lot of effort to overthrow him.
So Matthew, what he could do. Yeah, Matthew, these globalist one-worlders, they never got over the Revolutionary War. They just didn't get over that, and they never have.
No, they never forgave America. Never.
They never got over that Americans wanted to be free. Wow. It's so interesting. Yeah. I wonder, there must be some real karmic, a lot of reincarnation things going on in that set, these people, the blue bloods and all that. They must come back again and again, you think, to just drive this thing forward. It's like they don't give up, do they? I just don't give up.
Well, there's certainly some divine justice, and I think that I encourage people to. I mean, I hosted a conference on the real Edgar Allan Poe, which people could find on the symposium section of our Rising Tide site. It was three presentations on who Edgar Allan Poe really was, knowing this deeper history, because he was not this morbid figure, but he was probably one of the greatest epistemological warriors of America's experience. Who really struggled very hard to wage a fight that people don't fully understand. And in a lot of his stories, he's clinically addressing the self-destruction of evil. And he gets at it directly with the oligarchy and the British Empire's sort of aristocratic agenda in The Fall of the House of Usher and in The Mask of the Red Death. You read these with this in mind and just look at what he's doing. By pointing out that the nature of evil, when you allow yourself to be governed by your unresolved inner demons, you don't discipline and mature your soul to a proper state of maturity. But when you act on these impulses that you haven't even fully discovered yourself what they are, you will always do things which will cause you to undo yourself. So his characters, whether it's the Black Cat or anybody, they're always destroying themselves, which is this lawfulness, I think, of natural law that doesn't tolerate evil forever. It tolerates it for a little while, but ultimately evil is something which is not in harmony with the goodness of the universe.
So soul will continue to create problems for itself, in my opinion, so it'll grow up a little bit and learn some lessons.
I would say so. I hope that the future progeny of the empire will look back on this. I mean, we've had examples of good people who were born to royal families who were disgusted by their evil family traditions and who broke from it. There's not many of them, but we do have examples of that in our history, like Louis the 11th of France or Henry the 7th. Who unleashed the Tudor Renaissance movement. These were people who saw themselves as kings. Not because of their bloodline, but because, they had a responsibility to be servants of the people, to be instruments of God's will. And that was a very different idea than the dominant form that we live with today, unfortunately.
And that allegory whatever the term is goes way, way back with the spiritual teachers like Buddha supposedly was born to a rich family, and he went out, you know, to find God and walked around. That whole idea is very deep in the story of man, I think.
Oh, yeah. I think it's a deep archetype. Certainly get that. Absolutely. You get it in Confucianism, in India, in the Western system. Yeah, it's everywhere. It keeps coming back. That's right. And that the idea that you don't have to go to a priest class like Buddha realized, you know, the priests of the world he lived in didn't have a good answer for why there was so much injustice and poverty, and so he had to go on a spiritual journey. And the same thing happened with Christ, you know, essentially realizing that the Pharisees of his day were not giving, they were only accelerating the problem of injustice, and religion had lost its spirit. It had turned into a social control. So everybody, you know, we see this all over the world as a common sort of insight.
Go back to this X Club back in around Lincoln's time, and these 12 guys, kind of financed by the Fabian and the Rhodes boys, and one was a Darwin, social Darwin guy. So they created this Nature magazine, and today Nature is still one of the most prestigious kind of theoretically scientific journals out there.
Oh yeah, it's amazing. Nature and Science, I'd say, are the two biggest. Nature is the biggest, and it's one of these things that contaminates modern science practices. You know, you're always told if you don't publish, you perish as a scientist. And if you're published in Nature, you're good. You'll get respect. You'll get grants. You'll get you'll be peer reviewed, and you'll be accepted in the community.
Right.
You won't have to worry financially. And now it exerts a huge influence, and it was set up, like you said, by the X Club in 1869 as a propaganda outlet to promote their view of things. It throughout the 1900s, they continued to influence the spread of eugenics. Mm-hmm. The rise of the new Malthusian movement after World War II happened under I don't know how your readers, if everyone's looked into this, or maybe some people have and some people haven't, but unfortunately, the rise of modern environmentalism under Prince Philip, who created the World Wildlife Fund for Nature along with Prince Bernhard in 1961, and Julian Huxley was the third co-founder of that. These are the people that created the Bilderberger groups. They created then, you know, is it a coincidence that they then created the World Wildlife Fund for Nature and the Nature Conservation Trust in the 1960s? No, that was not a coincidence. The funding of things like the Population Bomb, Limits to Growth, the Club of Rome, That was the new Malthusian movement that was created by those same very people who were funding Hitler and eugenist solutions to world population problems before Hitler and during. Hitler just made that look very bad publicly, so people wouldn't accept it anymore.
The same people. And what could be wrong with the World Wildlife Fund? It sounds so natural. World Wildlife. What's wrong with wildlife?
It's like Greenpeace, you know. Yeah. Greenpeace. I like both of those things. I want a green world. I don't want to cement everything.
Right.
I like peace. Why? But you know, as Patrick Moore, one of the co-founders of Greenpeace, has made the point in his many years of lectures, this thing was taken over. It lost its way. It was set up originally to be about peace and against nuclear war, and it was hijacked or very early on by these same institutions that created the World Wildlife Fund in order to promote a Malthusian anti-human view of human beings and essentially advance a new form of empire, as disgusting as that might be. That's what happened.
So Matthew Herrett, how did this X Club and Nature get all embroiled in the whole contemporary medicine today? Did they do it through Rockefeller and Carnegie in the early 1900s and the modern medicine that we have today, treating symptoms and surgeries and pharmaceuticals?
Yeah, I think we have about 10 minutes left for this interview, right?
No, we can keep going. No, we got time.
Oh, okay, sure.
Yeah.
Okay. That's right. They were embroiled early on with the Rockefeller Foundation. Nature was always London-based, so it didn't need Rockefeller funding. Mm-hmm. That was more for the infusion of these British ideas into America. That's where the Rockefeller and Carnegie Foundations and their philanthropic sort of process came out of.
Mm-hmm.
They were just the money bags. You know, it's kind of like, anyway, it's another side story. Nature, though, did fund, they broke a lot of careers. You mentioned at the very beginning, Jacques Benveniste, who was a great French scientist who had been doing incredible pioneering work on water memory and looking at how water has this quality of retaining the attributes, the memory, the information of living tissue that embeds, it imprints its information into the water itself, such that when the living tissue of an animal organ or whatever is taken out of that water, it still continues to exert the influence of the enzymes of the tissue, even though there's no enzymes present. It's been highly diluted water. His Wow. career and life were largely shattered by Nature Magazine's frauds to fallaciously, they both published his study in the late 80s, the results of his study. And then when they tried to do a verification study, and they do this for many people, they fudge the data, they push the limits, the parameters of the study beyond reason to the point that they cause it to fail and then publish the results of the failure, saying that he was thus a fraud and his life was shattered. He was working out of a little makeshift lab in the parking lot of his former French, I think it was the Louis Pasteur Institute, for the last 15 years of his life. You know, bringing it into the current situation today, Nature Magazine, what originally put that on my agenda to write about that was that Fauci had cited Nature's official definitive study that was run by a team of evolutionary virologists, which Fauci made the point should shut down any discussion of those who think that that COVID might have any laboratory origins to them. And obviously there's a lot of people who have come out, scientists like Dr. Luc Montigny, Judy Mikovits, Francis Boyle is a biowarfare expert, and there's many others who have looked at a lot of the gene sequencing and have noted that there's too many anomalies, there's too many gain of function aspects of it, there's too many splicing of HIV in strange places within the COVID, the SARS strain, that it couldn't have just occurred naturally in any statistically meaningful way. It most likely did occur in a laboratory. And so when Fauci started promoting this and Gates and the World Health Organization started promoting this Nature study as like the thing, I was like, well, what is Nature? And I'd already produced some material on this over the years and on my Canadian Patriots site. But that was very useful to say, well, is this a legitimate scientific platform, or is there a political agenda that is behind it now, and perhaps that has always been behind it? And that's where we start getting this whole picture coming together. Nature, that's the thing. There's a lot of scientists who have written about this, their experiences, who have tried to resist the narrative of, I brought up global warming. Anybody who has tried to publish material on the cosmological, the astrophysical aspects of climate change, that it's, you have to look at what's the sun doing, what is cosmic radiation doing, what about the electromagnetic fields and how they pulse and fluctuate, sure, that generates the changes of the ecosystem on the Earth, which does. I mean, I'll just say this right now. If you want to know global climate change, cosmic radiation is really where you got to look, and there's a lot of good science that's been done on this. But Nature Magazine has crushed people who have tried to put that out in their papers, and they to promote the accepted narrative that no, this is just human anthropogenic CO2,
yes,
which is that's what happens when you industrialize a society, which is what America did in the 19th century, and that is what allowed us to get rid of slavery, was that a machine could do the work of 1,000 men. So you don't need slavery if you encourage the development of ever better forms of machines and ever better forms of resources that allow you to escape the limits of existence of a former lower quality resource base, right? So you're always facing limits because resources are always limited. They're always material. But the mind is immaterial. It's metaphysical, and it allows us to escape the shackles of a lower set of limits to when we discover oil that – farmers used to think of as being a pain in the ass. If you were a farmer and you found oil on your fields in the 1900s, that was bad because you couldn't plant there. you had to like buy a new field and move off. And it, so it took a while for people to discover that, no, this could actually be burnt, applied to combustion engines, and put to work. That gave it value. It didn't have value, right? Same thing for coal. Before a certain point, coal had no value. Before the Iron Age, iron had no value. The atom had no value. It was just used for dyeing glass, you know, in the medieval periods. So right. Everything occurs by the mind's creative powers.
Yes.
And that's what
they don't want.
Tried to destroy.
Yeah, that's what. So Nature magazine and the Fauci people and the natural. I don't understand why. If their goal was, I don't know, with this COVID thing, there's a lot of different goals and a lot of money being made and control and behavior modification and all of this, as you know, going on. Why do they care if people think it's out of a lab or a natural kind of a thing? I mean, why do they even care about that as long as they're achieving their goals?
Well, I think personally, in looking at some of the political players behind this thing, I don't have a full picture. I don't know. Mm-hmm. I don't know all of the answers to the question of vaccines and all these things.
Yeah.
I've listened to Judy Mikovits quite a bit, and I've heard a lot of material that's persuaded me. I used to be very, pretty much pro-vaccine.
Yes.
Not that long ago.
Mm-hmm.
At this point.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not against the principle of vaccines and amplifying your immune system, but certainly the way that they have been applied in the big pharma system of the last 30, 40, 50 years is, I see very nefarious ideas and objectives behind that.
Yeah.
Here's the thing. If it is, if it does have a lab origin to it, you would think about it completely differently, and you'd think about the remedies to it very differently than you would if it came organically out of nature, right?
Gotcha.
So when somebody comes, promoting a miracle vaccine, if Bill Gates's operation starts saying, okay, we've got the cure now, and it becomes mandatory to apply it to everybody if you want to have a right to a license or a right to travel.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, your ability to decide whether this is a good idea or not is going to be affected by whether this arose in a lab or not. And if it arose in a lab, it means that there is a vaccine to it. And they're just waiting for a moment. Also, it means that if there are further waves of it, if it is a bioweapon, then if there are further waves, then this is something which they would be able to predict. So when I hear Fauci talking so definitively about second and third waves of this, without like a maybe, but it will. I don't like hearing stuff like that. I'm not saying get scared, but I don't think that should just be taken as is. So the laboratory thing does affect that too, and it can be seeded and deployed to disturb nations. Right now, I have a lot of trust. I've researched very deeply the multipolar alliance of Russia, China, the Belt and Road Initiative, which has resisted this one world anti-nation state view of the world order coming out of the British Empire. And I say the British Empire here because I don't believe in such a thing as an American empire. Anything that America has done as an empire, personally, has been by this British deep state thing inside of it, which is not American. So just for terminology so people don't get confused.
Which is why that Russia and China are the boogeyman, right?
That's exactly why they've been demonized so much. Yeah, exactly. By forces on the left and on the right alike who both have been promoting China and Russia as the new evil villains of the world. Mm-hmm. And this is, there's people who seem to be promoting an actual war agenda with them because they're actually doing, when you look at what China and Russia together have been doing, not only for their own countries, but also for Africa, for the Middle East, for South America, and what they've offered as a life raft for the collapsing Western basket case alliance of Europe and like the NATO countries, they've actually created a new paradigm, a new alternative system of political economy based upon win-win cooperation. They've lifted 800 million people out of poverty in China, and they're extending the idea of speculating with derivatives is impossible in the Chinese banking model. They have not allowed that. They've kept Glass-Steagall separation of commercial banking and investment banking. They're the only nation that's really kept that strong divide in place, and that's permitted them to invest in water projects, big infrastructure that have the effect, like Lincoln's system did back in the 19th century. It has the effect of both benefiting rich people, poor people. Everybody benefits because a rising tide lifts all boats. That's what Xi Jinping said, and that's why I gave my organization that that title. And it increases people's quality of life and cognitive capacities who benefit from all of a sudden having access to water to having an engineering society instead of a slave society walking 12 miles every day to get some water from a dirty well.
Yeah. So they're using the idea.
So that's what the empire wants to destroy.
Yeah. So they're using the idea. China, they are their own central bank. They don't borrow it from the Fed like we do, private banks. And then they can create yuan and build stuff that generates GDP and employment and stuff, which, you know, I guess if you're going to be a fiat currency guy, if you do that, it's not so terrible.
No, exactly. It's good common sense banking. It's not sexy, you know, Wall Street hedge fund banking with cocaine, you know, being sniffed every to keep these speculators up 90 hours a day. So the Wolf of Wall Street, right? It's not like that.
Yeah, I understand.
You go to jail if you try to do things like that in the Chinese banking system.
So that's a little disconnect, though, when you look at President Trump, because he's all over China, and not Russia, but China now, and they're the bad guys of the world, and he wants them to pay him the tariffs and all that, which would be more playing into the globalist hand, but, you know, he really is a nationalist, too, so how does that square, I wonder?
Okay, well, the thing about Trump, he's waging a very complex fight. This was already bad when John F. Kennedy was fighting the deep state in his day, and firing, you know, Alan Dulles from the CIA. It didn't get better after JFK was killed. It got worse.
Yeah.
It's a miracle that Trump has even managed to succeed to the point that he has it.
Yeah.
My mind is blown every time I look at this. Now, the thing about Trump is that what he says on Twitter, what he sometimes says publicly, or what is said in his name by people within his own administration is not actually how he thinks. I haven't seen any evidence of that since I've been following him very closely since 2012, and especially since becoming president. Now, he has a lot of deep state and very deep state affit people like Pompeo embedded within his administration and a lot of interests he has to balance and navigate around to sort of stay in power. It's a very complex balancing act he walks.
Yeah.
I don't fully understand all of it because I'm not on the inside. But I do know that he has, for example, called repeatedly for positive relations with Russia and China even before he was elected, and consistently since. He just signed a cooperative program with Roscosmos and NASA to jointly develop lunar systems. Both countries have major space programs right now, as does China. I put a very high value on that because the approach to space is that it breaks the Malthus Darwin system is always premised around closed systems, finite closed systems. It's a science of limits. That's how the empire likes to keep us in our cage, our mental cage. Space is a science of overcoming limits. There's always more to discover, to improve upon when we go there. And you can never rest on a fixed state of knowledge if you commit to getting out of the comfortable bounds of the womb that we evolved in on the Earth, and you start going out, you know, and extending human civilization onto other planets. You can't ever allow that society to be in a stagnant, fixed position. There's no comfort zone you could be in. So I like that approach. Now Trump just signed that. He also had a joint letter with Putin a few days ago celebrating the Elba Day event. I mean, so he's done things like that. And I know that there is a fight inside of the American presidency between, again, the war faction, the Pompeos, who oftentimes a lot of Americans are confused because they see Pompeo or they see a lot of people like Attorney General Barr and others do a very good job, and I like Barr. I think he's a good guy. But, you know, they see them do a good job exposing the deep state in America, and it's satisfying, you know, to actually see this thing finally being exposed, like the Russiagate collapsing right now is a joy for me to watch. And to see Flynn being exonerated, I really appreciate seeing this stuff. But then they're so stupid on China. They're stupid on even on Russia, but the right-wingers tend to be much more stupid on China. The left-wingers you know, people who are on the radical left tend to be completely stupid about Russia being the big villain. But there's so little clarity of the actual nature of the game. I think Trump does have that sense of clarity, though sometimes his words betray that. But I do think that he is on a better thinking plane. I do think he has a lot to learn about economics, though. I don't think he gets the need for America to reindustrialize.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
He gets that.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think he understands how that's going to happen properly. You're not going to get it by cutting off relations with China. I mean, there's 50 years of collapse of our industrial factories and productive processes that it's going to take a while to reheal and rebuild that capacity. So by just simply cutting China off, you can't do it that way. You have to have a different approach. And I think in that sense, I don't know what he knows.
Yeah, I understand. Matthew, stay right there. Can you stick around for a few more minutes?
Of course.
Yeah, cool. I'm having fun. Boy, he's interesting to talk with. Huh? Matthew Arrett, and I talked about the X Club, and you can view Matthew's website, which is the, got it right here. I'll give you all his websites in just a second. Well, we have a couple of cool sales going on, and one of them is with some Sir Thrival products, and here's something on it.
Previously with Peter Ragnar, who's a great example of staying young and healthy, we asked him what kinds of things he takes.
Personally, for myself, I look at all of the supplements that help bolster and harmonize my hormones. And, you know, this is both for men and for women. And when you go online, there's so much information about that out there. I heard on one of your advertisements there, Patrick, about the pine pollen. I personally take pine pollen, which I think it's an amazing product, has an amazing effect upon the body.
Peter, it's one of our favorites, too. Pine pollen, any of these are Thrival links. You have the pine pollen pure potency, pine pollen gold, and if you'd like to get it every month, the auto ship is the best price. Also, Stephen Buhner's book, exclusively on pine pollen, is right there on the site, too, Daniel's site, right here on OneRadioNetwork.com.
Baby, yeah, and we've got some pretty good sales going on with Sir Thrival right now. If you want to use promo code Robust15, promo code Robust15, you can get some CBD oil, some Elk Velvet Antler, and Taboo, all on sale, Robust15. And I think we all have a couple of other things, too. And Shizandra Berry Extract is also with promo code Robust15. So pine pollen is not, but the pine pollen and the Elk Velvet Antler, we think that these are two of the real go-tos if you want to boost up your testosterone, guys. Pine pollen and Elk Velvet Antler on Sir Thrival. Really, really great products. David Wolf was very bullish on Shaga and Rishi. He said, and David's been at this for 30 years or so. He said, if you take Shaga and Rishi every day for the rest of your life, you'll probably 5 years from now, you never get sick from anything. And he's probably right. The dual extraction, fruited bodies with the dual extraction that Daniel Vitalis has is phenomenal, where it works right on different little buggies that keep crawling around that shouldn't be there, and also works with the body's immune system. That's the dual extraction process with fruited bodies of these wonderful mushrooms, Shaga and Rishi. Very, very powerful. And these are adaptogens where you could take them every day and your body's not going to get all screwy and not have them work anymore. They're adaptogens. That means you can take them every day forever. Any Sir Thrival link, OneRadioNetwork.com. This hydrogen, Brown's gas, we think is one of the I think it's going to be, for this time, just the most amazing technology that's come to the forefront in the last 10 years, and we've got a machine that'll make it for you, and it's on sale 20% off today. 20% off, check it out. This is from a previous show with Dr. Mark Serkis.
So 3 months ago, a study that was published in Dove Press brain metastasis completely disappear in non-small cell lung cancer using hydrogen gas inhalation. A case study done in China, a 44-year-old woman diagnosed with multiple metastases.
What's a metastasis?
Means it spread.
It's spreading.
It's spreading. Not just one tumor. She had multiple tumors.
Uh-huh.
The kind of case where there's no hope. Doctors give up hope. Complete remission using hydrogen gas.
Really?
In terms of brain cancer, and of course in my hydrogen book, which people can download from my site, quite a bit of information about using hydrogen for cancer and the many reasons and studies that lead up to that. But this study that I'm talking about today, it's
amazing.
It's like taking a two by four and smashing it over the sign of modern oncology. Like, wake up, boys. Here's something simple, something you should be doing anyway, that happens to help people with the worst forms of cancer, almost doomed to die.
If these studies on breathing hydrogen gas in cancer cells are accurate, imagine the possibilities of what this technology can do for you and I when we breathe it and drink the water. Peer-reviewed studies have shown it's the best antioxidant known to man. What exactly is it doing? I have no idea. We have the AquaCure Brown's Gas Hydrogen Machine, and it's now on sale, 20%. 20%. Yeah, antioxidant. Oxidation, so much out there. If you go to molecularhydrogeninstitute.com and look at their studies, and these are peer-reviewed, literally thousands of studies on hydrogens and what it can do, of what it has done for people and is doing for people all over the world, breathing the gas and bubbling the water. It's all right there for you. We have a 20% deal right now for the next, I think, 5 days, and that's it. Use promo code ONERADIO, 20%, and you breathe it. Now, this machine produces Brown's gas, which is a step up from hydrogen. And Yul Brown, who was literally destroyed by the deep state, medical industrial complex for his work with hydrogen and Brown's gas, because it works. It always happens to people when they have stuff that works, like the fellow our guest Matthew was talking about with this man in the water. That's what they do. They did it with Dr. Hal Huggins in Mercury. They're doing it today with the people that are promoting chlorine dioxide. The FDA is all over it right now because people are using it for the COVID thing. So they came out with a big release. So that's the real proof when something works, is when people try to, you know, these people that we talk about try to dampen the use of it. The Brown's gas puts more electrons into the body, into the water, which makes it a lower ORP, and which makes it more hydrating for the body and makes it more useful. And as you know, water is pretty magical thing when you get to clean it up, and now you put hydrogen in it. So it's a Brown's gas machine, the AquaCure, 20%. George has sprung this sale on it. I can assure you it's not going to happen again, a sale for a long, long time. Maybe Christmas, I don't know. 20%, use promo code ONERADIO. Yeah, there's a little confusion on the hydrogen and Brown's gas. I get the question, but know that this does make hydrogen and Brown's gas.
Source. OneRadioNetwork.com.
I almost said it right.
Know the source. One Radio Network.
Well, we're having a great conversation. I appreciate your time, Matthew. This is fun. You're fun to talk to. Matthew Errett is a Rising Tide Foundation and Canadian Patriot Review. Those are your two main websites, right?
Yeah, actually, if people want to find them, they would have to type in risingtidefoundation.net mm-hmm. and canadianpatriot.org.
Canadianpatriot.org. So Before we wrap up, let's talk about this whole financial thing. It's really hard to know, and I'd like to get your take, because you obviously do deep research into this, of this whole COVID phenomenon and the forces behind it, you know, with the fake death and the testing that's not right, and now the vaccine and Fauci and the second wave and third wave, and the people behind this and what it's done for to the financial system. But you have written, and we know that this wasn't a COVID crisis, right? This thing was blowing up for a long time, since 2008. I wonder what you think that the people, the New World Order folks, the globalists have in mind now. I know it's hard, tough to make predictions when it involves the future, but what are you thinking, that we're going to see another, this thing continuing like in 6 months or a year? What do you think?
Well, here, the thing of value I think I can contribute to that part of the conversation isn't so much in the detail. I mean, the detail, it's very much a state in flux. But what I see speaking as a historian, mm-hmm. is that we have come to a process very much similar to that crisis faced by the world in 1861. To 65.
Wow.
Which is that, you know, you have a clash of these two systems. In the case of the 19th century, it was the American and British systems. One was an open system, focused on the idea that value under the Lincoln program, the typically traditionally American program, was centered on the power of the human mind to make discoveries. So value was not something tied to worshiping money. It was not tied to debt. Slavery. So debt under the greenback system and under systems like Franklin Roosevelt's New Deal or John F. Kennedy's approach, money is a servant of the people. It's tied to long-term investments in things that cultivate real value, real discoveries, real industrial growth. Very different from the British system, which sees debt as being something to hold their victims underwater, more deeply underwater with no hope for recovery. They see money as something to worship as a god in speculative interests. That's how the British Empire always worked. And it's always based upon the non-existence of the human mind as a real entity, because the mind is not physical. They're materialists, right? They want to place everything in a material plane. The mind is like, that's where intentions and abstract ideas exist. That doesn't really have existence if you're a materialist. That's maybe only for the secret knowledge of the inner elite to control the ideas, the acceptable ideas, right? But not for the masses to learn about. All that to say, that's a closed system. So you have open systems versus closed systems clashing in the 19th century. It was only because the British were able, in their weakness, to unleash a lot of assassinations in the 1880s, 1890s, World War One, a few revolutions, World War II. They had to disrupt that natural evolutionary creative flow of mankind, which is exporting Lincoln's system internationally. So today, we have that same thing with Putin, Xi Jinping, the Belt and Road Alliance of 160 nations increasingly jumping on the Belt and Road framework of the new Silk Road. Trump represents a part of that pro-nation state, anti-Malthusian agenda. Then you have those who want to use this crisis, use the economic collapse as a way to just put a new system online centered around one world government, depopulation, and other things. Mm-hmm. So I think right now there's a fight to control the narrative. The China and Russia officially have acknowledged, you know, that the COVID crisis is real, but if you look at the way how Russia and China are choosing to treat it, it's very different from what London or Wall Street are choosing to do. So they're actually talking about building health infrastructure for Africa, you know, like really use this as an opportunity to create a new system that's of win-win cooperation and development, not forced vaccines on the masses under a new dictatorship. You know, they don't think that way. So there is this fight going, and I think that it's important to look at it that way, because the banking system is collapsing and it's not coming back. So in that sense, we are not going back. There's no such new normal. The oligarchy is right. There won't be a new normal or a return to normal. But is it going to be a system premised around this cooperation on space exploration, asteroid defense, new energy investments, things that actually have value, or is it going to be premised around this dystopic, you know, Huxleyan view of Brave New World, or H.G. Wells, who was a student of Thomas Huxley, who promoted, you know, the open conspiracy and the New World Order. That he's the one who coined that term. Will it be something more like that? That's really where we're at right now.
But people should be really thinking.
Exactly. They got to be solution oriented.
So we have Russia and China, and they're actually on a higher plane of consciousness than these New World Order boys?
Yeah, I mean, I'm not trying to say that it's all angels and peachy penis, but yeah, they're certainly operating on a much higher paradigm, a much superior form of an idea of human self-interest than the false self-interest of each against all of the Hobbesian view that's dominant in the Western paradigm.
But isn't China doing all kinds of weird things, Matthew, with their people and the freedoms and all that stuff? I mean, the commies?
Yeah. Huh? Well, look, I think that the thing that is important to keep in mind is if you're talking about things like social credit,
right,
things like that.
Yeah.
Number one, everything is in a process of change and evolution towards something, right? There's no fixed state.
Mm-hmm.
China, in the last 35, 40 years since Mao, Mao made a mess of China. And I think in many ways, some of that still haunts China's reputation today, some of the disasters of Maoism, the Cultural Revolution. But in the last 35, 40 years, there has been an ongoing move towards improvement. And it's not a finished state. There's things that I think China, because they're operating on a platform where the banking system is forced to be founded upon human beings and reality instead of speculation.
Yes.
There's certain philosophical programs in place that will allow certain things to be used in a non-destructive way currently. In terms of, like, you know, you look at the I'm not comfortable personally with that amount of surveillance of a society. However, look at look at the Five Eyes world that we're living in. If we want to be clear, we're living under a world where every single electronic device, you know, every cell phone, every laptop, every TV can be and often is used for data collection in prism, full spectrum, Five Eyes surveillance. We already have it, but we're doing it in a more insidious way, run by an empire. China does surveillance. It does things that, I don't think you can use our standards to them currently, but they're moving in a direction. That's my point, is that they're moving in a direction towards becoming qualified to be a democracy, which they're, you know, it's a slower process, but they've been able to remove 800 million people out of abject poverty in only 25 years. And we're going downwards. We're going backwards, back to the Stone Age.
Interesting. So in just about 3, 4, 5 minutes we have remaining, then we have another guest coming up. Sure. So if we talk about banking, and so we have the Treasury now, probably, you know, bonded debt would be what, Matthew, I don't know, 30 trillion really, probably bonded debt, and then unfunded liabilities, maybe 75 trillion, they say. And we're borrowing money from the private bankers, which are the people that own Dollar Inc. There's really nowhere you can go from here, is there? I mean, you can't get to a gold standard, or you'd almost have to crash the whole thing, or Trump would have to just take over the Fed, and, you know, boy, that would be, he'd be in a lot of trouble there, and start printing his own United States notes and paying them off with his own, I don't know. How's the United States going to even get out of this thing?
Well, he can do that. I've written extensively
at his own risk. He'll do that, right? Phew.
Oh yeah, I mean the system's going to blow out. It's already a time bomb, and the derivatives contracts that were built up since 1987 under Greenspan. Yeah. This is the big time bomb that's being set to blow out the world financial system, especially in the West. Which, I mean, at this point, it's $1.5 quadrillion of derivative contracts built into the system, 40 times more than the world GDP. It doesn't mean anything. So when you get a default of a whether it's corporate debt or some other sector of junk bonds, which are currently being bailed out to the tune, like you said, of $3.5 trillion, if you get a default in any one of these places, you can get an easy chain reaction of the disappearance of
quadrillions of dollars. That would then just create total anarchy. By printing money, we are unleashing hyperinflation as a process, which we saw didn't do any favors for Germany in 1923, and that's what gave birth to the Nazi economic system of Fialmarschacht. So you will need a reset, but it's got to be done under sovereign nation states reorganizing it the way Franklin Roosevelt did in the 1930s, which I've also written about, and people can look on my website on how that's done. But you got to break up the banks. You have to wipe out the unpayable debts. You have to do a serious audit. And you have to then start, like you said, use the principle of national banking.
Yeah.
Issue credit backed by the government, backed by the Treasury, not by private mm-hmm. Federal Reserve.
Mm-hmm.
Or force the Federal Reserve, like you said, to become a national institution. You could do that if you want. There's so many ways to do it. But you got to also do it with the cooperation of other countries, because you have to do it with – Russia and China and other countries of the Belt and Road have created a new – framework of political economy, and they want to work. It's an open system, and they've invited the West to join and cooperate on that. We got to say yes instead of keeping on the war policy against them. That would help create a basis of trust building and cooperation to reheal our lost factories in a way which benefits everybody.
Yeah, I'm kind of thinking you could do. See, I'm just waving a magic wand here just for fun before we go, Matthew. You could create United States notes. And have everybody, it'd be a one-for-one, have everybody turn in their Federal Reserve notes. And I think there's probably $20 trillion out there under the mattresses. liquid cash, right? Money markets.
Sure.
Trade in their one-for-one. You get a United States note, and you gather the $20 trillion Federal Reserve notes, and you pay off the Fed that we owe them about $6 trillion. Here's your Federal Reserve notes. You can have these guys back. I think it could be done. Of course, President Trump would have to have some Kevlar vest and probably stay in a bunker for a while. But, it would take a real man to do that one, wouldn't it?
Now's the time for balls. That's
that's right. No sense in being timid now. Well, it's great talking to you, Matthew. Thanks so much. Tell folks again your two websites.
Yeah, sure. Thanks for having me on.
Oh, yeah.
My two websites are risingtidefoundation.net, canadianpatriot.org. And yeah, everything, my Patreon, other stuff that they want to find, if they want to help out that project, they can do so on those websites.
Well, you're a real thinker. You're a real critical thinker. And it's a commodity that we need more of, Matthew Everett. So I appreciate you being here this morning. I had a good time.
Thanks. Me too.
All right. Bye-bye. Matthew Everett. Bye. Yeah, we love people that think for a living, right? Woo. Hey. Okay, we have another thinker coming up, David Martin. I think you're going to like him. Boy, I saw a couple of his videos and contacted him, and we're going to do it. So it's coming right up. Stay there. Patrick Timpone, OneRadioNetwork.com. Take care, and we're going to be right back, okay?
We are listener-supported. One Radio Network.